From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Republicans won back full control of Congress in yesterday's elections by a narrow but decisive margin. It's a resounding victory for the Bush administration. White House officials are already looking at how to capitalize on the Republicans' new legislative dominance. In this hour, power shift in Washington, a new Republican majority, and the next GOP revolution. We begin with analysis of the GOP victory. The Republicans won back the Senate with at least a 51-seat majority and strengthened their hold on the House. As the GOP celebrates its historic triumph, downcast Democrats look to regroup. Joining me now from Atlanta is Bill Schneider, chief political correspondent with CNN. Good evening and welcome, Bill Schneider.
My pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. We know you're in the Atlanta airport. It's that kind of day. Everybody's moving and thinking and trying to understand what happened yesterday. Bill Schneider, you know these numbers. We didn't get the kind of election polling that you're accustomed to having. But what can you tell us about the deep archaeology of what transpired at the polls yesterday?
Well, there's not a lot of deep archaeology because the data wasn't dug up in time. But we can tell you that there were some interesting indications of what happened. We know that the weekend before the election, when we polled people around the country, we saw a Republican sweep coming. And what seemed to be behind it was the enthusiasm of Republicans. George Bush's travels around the country, his campaign, which took him to 40 states in the weeks before the election, drove up the enthusiasm of Republicans.
A visceral response there.
Absolutely. We found about two-thirds of Republicans saying they were more enthusiastic this time than they've been in past elections. Barely half of Democrats felt that way. So it's pretty clear that what Bush did was what he intended to do. He rallied the base. The Democrats did not do that, in part because they didn't have a messenger comparable to George Bush who was capable of doing that.
So how much do you attribute to George Bush, and how much do you attribute to circumstances?
Oh, I attribute a lot to George Bush. I think this was basically a referendum in which Bush was the central figure. As I say, he rallied the Republican Party. They adore George Bush, but Democrats don't hate George Bush the way, say, Republicans once hated Bill Clinton. So the risk was always that by traveling around, he would drive up Democratic turnout against him. But that didn't really happen, because while Democrats don't agree with President Bush, they don't really have that kind of visceral dislike for him, at least most Democrats don't. And Democrats didn't find very many issues to rally around. They didn't find their party leadership particularly inspiring. A lot of Democrats are criticizing the leadership in Congress as being timid, unwilling to stand up and show any fight, not willing to take a strong position on either Iraq or the economy. So a lot of Democrats just didn't bother.
You know that historically, Bill Schneider, of course, this just doesn't happen. Presidents don't bring home this kind of midterm election victory, especially in their first term. Here, George Bush was looking at a pretty crummy economy, a lot of security concerns in the world. We saw in polls before the election, we thought that security issues were down at the bottom of the list of voters' concerns, but they somehow seem to have created a backdrop for this victory.
Well, I think they weren't. They were not at the top of people's concerns. The economy was. And that was the miracle. It was kind of a minor miracle that went on in the election yesterday, because Bush overcame widespread economic anxiety, which is real, and a lot of anxiety about the war, which is also real. And he made it a vote of confidence in him and his leadership. Mostly because Democrats weren't angry. They were nervous. They were anxious. I think September 11th had something to do with it because, of course, that raised the president's stature and embellished his image as a leader. But I'm not sure people were voting on 9/11 or the prospect of war with Iraq. They were voting on leadership.
How about the Democrats? Down and out now or just down?
They are down. I'm not sure they're out. Much depends on what happens in Iraq and what happens with the economy and whether the Republicans have learned since the last time this happened. The last time this happened was in 1994 in Clinton's first midterm, which was exactly the opposite of this. It was a massive repudiation of the president. And if you remember what happened in that case, Republicans took over Congress for the first time in 40 years. Newt Gingrich took over the contract with America. They took the lead in interpreting it as a massive conservative mandate, overinterpreted that mandate, alienated an awful lot of people, and allowed the president to play off them. One imagines, one hopes, that the Republicans have learned a lesson since then and aren't going to try to be quite as foolhardy as they were under Newt Gingrich.
And yet there's a big agenda sitting there. Not a lot of it has moved in the first first half of George Bush's term. How aggressively do you see Republicans coming now to the agenda of stymied items that have been waiting, I guess, for this day, for this majority?
I think a lot of the items will move. I'm not sure that they're I think they're going to try to withstand pressure from the religious right and the social conservatives, because they know that way lies trouble. When we interviewed Trent Lott today on CNN, he didn't talk about those issues. He didn't want to talk about abortion. He said, we want to move forward on homeland security. And there, Democrats appear to have made a terrible strategic mistake by refusing to back the president's homeland security plan because the unions didn't like it. They thought it violated workers' rights. The Democrats held it up. And that clearly cost a crucial Senate seat in Georgia, where Max Cleland, a triple amputee and war veteran, was defeated because he was considered, he was called weak on security because he didn't vote for the bill. That bill will pass, probably in the lame duck session. A budget will pass. Clearly at the top of the Republicans' agenda are permanent tax cuts, making the Bush tax cut permanent. Those sorts of things will get through pretty quickly. Probably an energy plan involving a lot of energy drilling. The more contentious part of the agenda is going to be his judicial appointments that have to go through the Senate. There, of course, the minority continues to have a considerable amount of power.
So a victory for the president. What is it in the character, in what this president communicates, do you think, Bill Schneider, that attracts that swooning Republican response and the grudging respect of Democrats?
Well, you said the word, character. That's what they admire about George Bush. That was the big contrast that got him elected, because he seemed so different from Bill Clinton. And that's protected him mightily. Even though we have this corporate abuse scandal, even though this administration is filled with corporate CEOs more than any other administration, two energy executives at the top from Texas, Bush and Cheney, so about four CEOs in the cabinet, you'd think that the corporate responsibility scandal would have just blown them out of the water. But it didn't. And that's largely attributable to the fact that people don't really have doubts about Bush's personal integrity. Also, of course, they acted quickly to target wrongdoers and get a bill through Congress that toughened penalties. But I think most of it is due to the fact that Bush has an image of character, integrity, and since September 11th, decisive leadership.
Bill Schneider, catch that flight. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bill Schneider is chief political correspondent with CNN. He spoke with us from Atlanta. Just a day after the midterm elections, White House officials have already begun to map out the path of the next Republican revolution or something like it. The agenda is brimming. The majorities are ready. What do you want? What do you expect from the new Republican Washington? George W. Bush's Washington. Where are we headed now on war, the economy, health care, the works? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington is John Fortier, political scientist at the American Enterprise Institute. Good evening and welcome, John Fortier.
Good evening, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. Also joining me in the studio tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
John Fortier, we're looking at the agenda tonight, at the power shift in Washington and what it portends. What do you see at the top of the Bush list coming into this new scene? They've got White House, House, and Senate. How will George Bush want to use his new majorities?
Well, I do think it's a very personal victory for Bush. He really invested himself in these races in a way that, that other presidents haven't. And he sees in his father's example, in his father's negative example, the importance of using political capital when one acquires it. And he has political capital now. I mean, ultimately, these margins aren't the largest in the world. And down the road, it may be difficult for him. But he's got a period, a sort of second honeymoon period, where he is going to push several agenda items. And I think it's going to start right in a lame duck session with Homeland Security. It is an issue that divided the parties. It divided over a relatively minor issue of civil service protections, not the essential character of the department. And it is something that played well in at least the South and other parts of the country. So I think you come right back. The Republicans actually take a majority in the lame duck session because of a couple of quirks in our electoral system where some of the Republican senators are going to take office right away. They'll have a small majority, and I think that'll be an issue that'll come up right away.
So the lame duck won't be so lame. We're likely to see some action on that bill. Of course, the Democrats painted the civil service aspect of it as very significant. Maybe that doesn't matter now.
there are some differences, and one could argue it either way, but ultimately, sometimes elections settle these things, and I think the Democrats are not going to want to fight this fight again. It may be that Bush offers a sort of small compromise in their direction, but He has the strength on this issue, and I think it's going to go through more or less as he laid it out.
So Homeland Security, first up, let's say he gets that under his belt, and I'm assuming from what you're saying that even with a 51-seat majority in the Senate, he can do that. What next? Is there something else for the lame duck session here, or then do we wait for the State of the Union address and the big rollout?
Well, the lame duck session, there's one important thing we do have to deal with, and that is making sure that our government continues functioning either with a continuing resolution, which allows the government to sort of pay its bills until the next session and they pass a budget, or to pass appropriations bills, or to actually go ahead and pass the appropriations bill. So at some point they have to deal with that. It's not clear whether they'll deal with that right away or sort of push it down the line to January. Judicial nominations. This is an issue that Bush has made a point of recently. He feels that his nominations have taken an inordinate amount of time in the Senate. They now have control. It's a one that he believes in, but it also plays well politically in certain cultural conservative parts of the country. In the South, it's an issue that resonates with Republican voters, that the liberal Democratic Judiciary Committee is holding up Bush's good conservative judges. That's mm-hmm. the way he would put it. So that certainly will be an issue, and there'll be a lot of
contentious. Can that begin right away? Can they begin processing that? Both Republicans and Democrats have complained, of course, over the last decade about the other party holding up their nominees. Is this outcome of yesterday's vote enough to begin pushing those more conservative judges through?
Well, they control the agenda. They control the floor. So they can bring up nominations for votes that they couldn't before. I mean, the Senate is a funny body in that it's not exactly a majoritarian body. And if you really want to do something, you often need 60 votes to mm-hmm. overcome a filibuster. Mm-hmm. The question is, at this time, do Democrats want to filibuster? Do they want to stop things, and what things they would want to stop? So I think Bush is going to push ahead with these. It may not be all of them in the lame duck session. It may be that he'll just continue to introduce them as we go along, or reintroduce nominees who haven't made it through. But it's certainly something that he will be pushing along, and some of them will be held up, and he'll blame the Democrats, and a number will get through because they'll actually get votes on the floor, and they'll peel off some Democrats.
And then there's war with Iraq. Decisions may have to be made well before State of the Union. Does the president need anything else from Congress on the war with Iraq front, or has he already got what he needs?
He has what he needs from Congress, but I think the election, in conjunction with the vote that he got in Congress a few weeks back, is going to be something he uses with the UN. I mean, we're close to a resolution, it seems, mm-hmm. and France and Russia are agreeing with it, but if there are snags, I think Bush is in a position of greater strength, that America is behind him, that he's raised security issues as an important issue in the election, and it's not something that our country hasn't considered and stood strongly behind him. So he's in a stronger position. It's likely that we'll get a resolution somewhat to his liking, but it's going to be primarily executive action after that, and it looks like we're going to do something in the early part of next year.
Yes, it does. Jack Beatty, George W. Bush, and the Republicans have done something that is not often done in a midterm election. What do you expect to come roaring out of this?
Well, maybe an electrifying appointment right out of the gate. Rudy Giuliani at the SEC.
Is that the word?
Well, I don't know. Think what that would do.
Tough guy at the helm.
I mean, suddenly,
he's no Harvey Pitt.
No, he's no Harvey Pitt. And you know, you talk about giving something that would give a fillip to the stock market. I mean, mm-hmm. having the, you know, Mr. Crime Fighter there. And there's some talk about Charles Schwab also has street credibility as the new Secretary of the Treasury. Mm-hmm. And talk about Chief Justice Rehnquist retiring. And there's a Hispanic appeals court justice who's very attractive, known to Bush. So that would be a very political appointment of some consequence. And, of course, Sandra Day O'Connor. She could become the new Chief Justice, first woman Chief Justice, or that would really be a fight. If she retires, the Democrats then have to really – that would be a fight because she's the swing vote on abortion rights.
Talk about a fight on the judiciary front. The Supreme Court may very well come into play in enormous ways in the next 2 years while this majority is sitting. We're talking tonight about George W. Bush's Republican triumph and the post-victory agenda, the GOP agenda. Now, what do you want? What do you expect from the new Republican Washington, George W. Bush's Washington? The legislative numbers have changed. How will the country now be changed? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is John Fortier. I'm here with Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George W. Bush's Republican triumph, maybe a looming Republican revolution again, about the GOP agenda now. You can join the conversation. What do you want to see at the top of the GOP, the dominant GOP agenda? Is this vote the true Bush mandate, and how should the president use it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is John Fortier. He's a political scientist at the influential, in Republican circles, American Enterprise Institute. And I'm here with Jack Beattie as well. John Fortier, beyond those top-of-the-pops issues, there's a lot that we heard about in the Bush campaign and that was kind of put on the back burner for much of these last 2 years. Look on down the road with us. What do you see for economic stimulus, for tax cuts, for welfare reform, health care, Medicare, Social Security? How much can the president and the Republicans tackle in this last half of his first term?
Well, I think tax cuts are, for the domestic agenda, going to be high, very high on the list. I think it's going to come up early in the session next January. I mean, the mantra of the Republicans in the election or in the recent campaign has been to make the tax cuts permanent. Bush ran basically on two large issues with some smaller issues, tax cuts and education, and is a sort of disciplined agenda type president. He came out of the box with tax cuts and education, didn't surprise anybody, and worked his way through them. We're gonna see an attempt to sort of fix in place the tax cut which he enacted in the first 8 months of his presidency, and partly because of financial considerations, we made some of the tax cuts end at a later date so that the taxes reestablish themselves. The death taxes, Republicans would call it, or estate tax, is about to disappear and then reappear again. This is an issue that Republicans are going to raise, and they think it's relatively popular, and they're looking to put Democrats on the spot in January.
Jack Beattie, it wasn't long ago, maybe 2 days ago, that people were still talking about those Bush taxes being tax cuts being rolled back, that the budget's in trouble, and that with a Democratic majority, or maybe even without it, it might be seen as necessary. Is that dust in the wind now?
I think so, and I think part of the problem is the Democrats. I mean, they have sought to blur the differences with the Republicans, and what has it got them? Well, what it got them is that their base defected. I mean, look at New Hampshire, Jeanne Shaheen. I agree with the president's tax cut. I agree with the war in Iraq.
I'm with him all the way, and I'm out of office.
Where's the differentiator with John Sununu? So she underperformed and conquered Manchester, Portsmouth with the Democratic base. And this was repeated all over the country by Democrats who embraced, who tried to blur the differences on issues with Bush. And they certainly did that on taxes. They didn't set up the election as, hey, do you want to fix Social Security? Or do you want to have a tax cut for people who leave estates over $2 million? Do you want to, deal with prescription drugs? Or do you want to continue a tax cut that's going to give $40,000 a year to the top 1% forever? They didn't set it up that way. They just said, we're not going to debate the tax cut.
John Fortier, what about it? You're inside the Republican thought bubble. Have you and your gang been kind of laughing in your beers over the way the Democrats have practically adopted the Republican point of view on so many significant issues?
Well, I guess I'd say that the Democrats have been sort of schizophrenic about the issue. You had most Democrats opposing the tax cut, but a significant number in states that Bush had done very well in, states in the South and out in the West, states where there were senators who were vulnerable, lost or almost lost this last election. Those were the supporters of the tax cut. And it became difficult for Tom Daschle to unify the party behind rolling back the tax cuts or opposing the tax cuts because many of his most vulnerable senators and reps also in the House were running as people who supported the president. Also, security issues. I mean, that's another issue that has to some extent divided the Democrats. I'd say mostly they've been with the president, but some more than others in the more vulnerable seats. So it's a difficult situation for the Democrats and how they're going to react to this because one school of thought is that you throw caution to the wind and you go for a more clearly differentiated agenda. We're going to actually have a fight in the House of Representatives for the leadership of the Democratic Party. House Minority Leader Gephardt announced that he is
probably not going to seek to be
re- seek
to come back.
Right,
in
not going
to
seize the leadership again, and that's not a surprise. There was some talk he'd run for president, but you've got a battle set up between Nancy Pelosi, who is a more traditional liberal from California, and Martin Frost, who represents a more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. You'll have a battle right there in the leadership. So it's something the Democrats are going to have some time, difficult time resolving.
Listeners, we're looking at the new agenda coming out of the big victory yesterday. Are we looking at a 2-year triumph or a 6-year, 8-year triumph for George W. Bush? And where is the U.S. headed in this new Republican world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Juliet is on the line. Hi, Juliet. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I have been registered as an independent, and after yesterday's debacle, I will, in fact, be registering as a Democrat.
Juliet, I'm sorry to say it, but your cell phone's going right out of its carrying capacity there, and we're losing you. Let's turn to another call. Call us back, Juliet, when you get in range. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Tom, how are you?
Well, thanks.
You know, the political pundits can ruminate and analyze all they want, and what they have to say is insightful, but I think when all is said and done, I think this was a visceral election result that the country, it was either the economy or Iraq, and especially 9/11, and the country rallied around Bush's leadership simply, it sounds primitive and simplistic, simply out of fear and anxiety. And I think that's why we see the trends we're seeing. And if you could ask Jack and John to discuss war elections, elections before a war and during a war, I wonder whether my assumptions are backed up by our history of political elections during war or just before war.
Let me ask you first, Paul, what is it about fear and anxiety that you think would push the country to George Bush and the Republican Party?
I think that there's a Baghdad invasion before Ramadan, that Bush takes this as a mandate, that the people really are frightened by what's going on. They do not know how to stop what may be inevitable. They are afraid of the vulnerability of our country as a result of 9/11. So rather than to figure out exactly what's going on and all the complexity of the world stage right now, they funnel everything into let's rally around our leader syndrome. We've seen this time and time again.
Paul, we've got it. Thanks for your call, Jack Beatty. I don't think we'll get into Baghdad before Ramadan. We're heading into that right now. But Paul points to the kind of legacy of wartime, presidency, leadership, elections. What is this chemistry? Does it change Americans' view of the world?
What's surprising is if you look at off-year elections for presidents in war, usually they do very poorly. Lincoln in 1862 suffered some decisive defeats. He also had some governors who helped him out, but it was not a good year. Woodrow Wilson, the off-year election of 1918 was catastrophic. He lost the Senate.
Of course, in both of those circumstances, they're in the middle. The blood is flowing.
That's right.
Here we have the animal spirits of war without the blood yet.
That's true. But we did have the blood on September 11th, and I think that is what has changed. Even in World War II, the election of 1942 was a debacle for the Democrats, even after Pearl Harbor. So Bush has reversed even that. It's true the blood isn't flowing, but the civilian blood was.
John Fortier, what about it? The ratio of fear and anxiety versus, I don't know, Republicans might say, opportunity. Which do you think is been most important in driving yesterday's outcome?
Well, I don't disagree that there's a visceral reaction to September 11th and that there is some fear and anxiety. I do think there's also a relative amount of confidence in the president, a security that Bush made the proper response, at least in the aftermath of September 11th, in the immediate aftermath. A lot of voters remember the speech that he made to Congress or various things that he said along the way, and we had relatively quick action in Afghanistan. And I think they understand also that this is a long-term problem which isn't easily solved. That being said, there is still some visceral fear, anxiety, and it certainly plays into an appeal to rallying around the flag. But I don't think it's completely unwarranted in this case. It could have gone a different way.
Mm-hmm. John Fortier, Jack, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation now James Pinkerton. He's joining us from Arlington, Virginia. He was a White House aide in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He's a columnist for Newsday and author of What Comes Next, The End of Big Government and the New Paradigm Ahead. Good evening and welcome, James Pinkerton.
Thank you. Call me Jim, please.
Okay, Jim, you have been sitting with a ringside seat at the Reagan administration, the first Bush administration. You see the victory that we all saw yesterday. How do you interpret this? Do we have a new Republican revolution here, a new mandate? How sweeping, how significant do you see this election result as being?
Well, I would have to say that it's pretty indicative of the mood of the country right now. I was just listening to a little bit of the byplay on midterm elections, and I guess I kind of come down on the side of, in the run-up to a conflict, there's enormous patriotic fervor. The example that leaps to mind is 1962 on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, happily, there was never a conflict there, but the Democrats did extremely well in the midterms. Their losses were sort of almost equivalent to what we saw on Tuesday. And there's a sense of crisis and rally around the president, and the Democrats did very well. When the blood starts flowing from the actual overseas war, that's a different story. When the Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor, in February of 1898, the reaction among Americans was almost unanimous that something had to be done, and that was a big boost for then-President McKinley.
James Pinkerton, look ahead with us here. We may have a two-year Bush ascendancy. Now we may have another 6 years. How big a change, pull way back, how big a change do you foresee in the America that essentially at the moment has been shaped by the Clinton decade? How big a transformation, a change do you see if it's 2 years, if it's a full 8-year, two-term presidency?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. I would say, though, that there are different political traditions. The political scientist Walter Russell Mead wrote a book just a little while ago, in which he identified four political science traditions, political traditions and character habits of Americans, the Wilsonians, the Jeffersonians, the Hamiltonians, and the one which sort of probably gets least attention, the Jacksonians, as in Andrew Jackson, the sort of frontiersman, dualist, very combative, pugnacious general and president in the early 19th century. And I think Mead's point is that at different times in our history, different elements of the American character come out to play. And I think right now that we're clearly in a Jacksonian phase where the mood is, you know, we can't even find Iraq on a map, but let's go bomb them. And I think that will last for a good long time, but I think it just speaks, the point is that whether it's the economic activism and open markets and free trade of the Clinton administration or the unilateralism and militarism of the Bush administration, you're just simply seeing another facet of what has been a pretty steady 2.25-century expansion of American power that obviously is still continuing. So whether or not it comes to a different phase in 2 years or 4 years or 10 years, I think the safe bet is that it's going to continue for a good long time for the rest of the century.
The disco ball turns. We've got a new facet. Tim is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Going along like with what he was talking there, I know I've been real frustrated over the last 17 months or so with the stagnation there. Nothing's being able to get done. We don't have the home security bill. We don't have a budget. Judges sitting there not being able to be pushed through. So with this, you know, hopefully things will start moving forward. And I think with the care and consideration that Bush has shown over this last 2 years that he has, you know, been president, that, you know, this is going to go in a good course. I mean, he's going to do one thing at a time. He's going to keep the public advised. He's going to consult with Congress like he has been doing or been trying to do. And then as these things go in, I think it's going to be good, you know, for the optimism of the country economically.
Well, we've got the picture, Tim. Thanks for calling in with it, Jack Beatty. There's a view, a Bush-supporting view of strength upon strength here, and out of that comes optimism and renewed vigor. in the country. I suppose there's a short end of the stick here, too. How do you see winners and losers beyond the congressmen in this outcome?
Well, I think the big winners are the Republican interest groups. I mean, politics drives policy, especially in Karl Rove's jurisdiction. So we can look for the drug and insurance lobby to get a bonanza. The insurance companies are going to get subsidies to reinsure the elderly for prescription drugs. The drug companies are not going to have this administered by Medicare, which would drive down drug prices. And also for the insurance hospital drug nexus, we're going to have tort reform. We're going to have malpractice reform, which is going to weaken one of the Democrats' prime interest groups, trial lawyers. That's a twofer. It weakens the other guy, pays off your guy. And I think that corporate America is going to get something here. There's been talk about reforming, quote-unquote, meaning cutting the corporate income tax. We may see that, and that would be a very significant move on the part of on the part of the president. And then I think he's going to, you know, weaken the other guy's interest groups. I don't think, you know, he dropped the voucher idea on education from the education bill last year. That may return because that's an idea that's going to keep coming up, and the Republicans are going to keep using it both as a policy issue but also as a political one to strike at the teachers' union.
John Forte, how about it? What do you expect from the Bush administration now on the health care front, prescription drugs, Medicare, the whole front? And is it, as Jack Beattie suggests, a kind of a industry payoff time?
Well, I guess I see one concern overlaying the other. I mean, there's the security concern that will always be there. And I think we're in this for the long haul, and there are going to be a number of episodes whether it's the war with Iraq and Homeland Security and other things that come up, which will sort of always invade our politics when we're maybe not expecting it. But underneath, we're still somewhat a 50-50 country. And Bush made an attempt to address that in his original campaign for president and in his early part of his days by calling himself a compassionate conservative. And that meant he was conservative in some ways. He certainly was for a tax cut, which appealed to his base. But he wanted education reform as well. And that was a bipartisan initiative, one he compromised on a lot and gave up some of the edges of it. On the issues of health care and—
But is the need for that behind us now?
I don't think it is. I think that Bush and Karl Rove are sensitive to the need for a domestic agenda. They see in Bush's father a sort of failure to come as directly as he might have off of a foreign policy triumph and look back to the domestic side. So I think they're always trying to play on that field as well. But it's gonna have some elements that'll appeal more to the base and some that'll appeal more to the middle. The tax cut, making the tax cut permanent, is again going to appeal to economic conservatives. And there are limits to this. We're going to have some budget issues as to how much we can actually lock in. But on the other side, Bush is going to try to pass a more modest prescription drug plan and blunt the issue that the Democrats might have put forward. He would say it's a more responsible prescription drug plan. Social Security is an interesting one because in that regard, Bush was a little more daring than he might have been in the original campaign, and that is looking for
some of the money to go to
private accounts. Yeah, and that hasn't played as well as one might think, but in certain age groups, in the younger age groups, it's still somewhat popular. So I think they're toying with that. They may reformulate it. It come out in a slightly different way, but it is something that he may pursue, which is a little more bold.
It may be back. We're talking about George W. Bush's Republican triumph and the GOP agenda. Now you can join us. What's your vision for George W. Bush's America? What does it look like? What will it look like? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This is WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about George W. Bush's Republican Revolution and the post-victory agenda. You can join us. What do you want? What do you expect from the new Republican Washington, George W. Bush's Washington? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are John Fortier, political scientist at the American Enterprise Institute, and James Pinkerton, who was a White House aide in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. You can join us as well. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, thanks.
Good. I've been a registered independent for a long time, and very frustrated with what's going on, being somebody who has always been more sympathetic to the left than the right. Mm-hmm. And I almost felt relieved with what happened with yesterday.
Why exactly, Paul?
And that it seems to be Democrats now are forced to create a new era, kind of like where the Republicans were for the the election in, was it, 94?
94, when they went off and made their contract with America.
Correct. It seems like that's the pattern now following for the Democrats, in that they're forced to start over. They can run a campaign now based on optimism as opposed to pessimism, which is, I think, one of the things that hurt them. They can get new leaders in there, new blood, and they won't be blamed for anything, you know, they won't be blamed for anything right now that happens in the next 2 years. I mean, the Republicans have everything they need to get done what they need to get done.
Well, or a good portion. They don't have 60 Senate seats, and maybe that will be the next rallying cry. But we take your point, Paul, and thanks for making it. Jack Beatty, how do you see that? Do you see the Democrats as having taken such a licking that they're going to go off now and emerge reborn?
It's very hard to imagine that, frankly, to me, given the personnel. I mean, wasn't it something in this campaign that they reach out to Frank Lautenberg and Walter Mondale, yesterday's men?
Creaking. Yeah. I mean, God bless
like
them,
the movie.
But still.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the movie Space Cowboys. They're come back for one last
to the rescue.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it's unfair perhaps to use that as a paradigm, but I think they're just kind of out of gas. I mean, the phrase that occurs to me about them is out is W. H. Auden's intellectual disgrace stares from every human face.
Ouch, Jack, from you even. James Pinkerton, I want to pick up on one word that Paul used there and ask you about it. He's talking about optimism. Tom Friedman in the New York Times had an interesting column from Berlin today, and where he was making the point that what he sees as the missing element in the winning Bush formula yesterday is this optimism. He said Bill Clinton was viewed by the world as the epitome of American optimism, even if it was naive optimism, that JFK, FDR, and Ronald Reagan had enemies more evil than Saddam or Osama without losing touch with that optimism and communicating it to the world. But he says he sees in the Bush team, the president, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Condi Rice, a kind of a view of the world as cynical pessimists who believe only in power politics. Do you sense a missing element of the organ chord here? Is there a missing optimism?
Well, I think they think they're optimistic. I think if you listen to what, for example, Paul Wolfowitz says about America's going to change the Middle East and democratize.
Well, that's optimism of a sort, yes.
That's optimism of a sort. That's right. I mean, it may not be, it's certainly not an optimism that Europeans buy. And it may not be an optimism that much of sort of, you know, the sort of the Atlanticist elites buy. But the Bush people are on I think to no small degree on a very different wavelength of optimism, which is they think they're doing God's work.
So it's a kind of can-do, we can go out and change this evil world.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that there's a redemptive quality there. I think that to go back and read Bush's book, the co-written with Karen Hughes, A Promise to Keep, one is struck by the degree to which he really is a sort of Jimmy Carter-like born again Christian,
and yet in Jimmy Carter, you feel that kind of hopeful faith in every man. In George Bush, Tom Friedman's writing, he sees the face of Thomas Hobbes, that assumption that every man is a wolf to every other man, that it's a dark and dangerous world where I guess the optimism is about triumph, but not necessarily about human nature itself.
Well, Hobbes was kind of a quiet agnostic or atheist. So Hobbes had his own view of things, but I think Bush sees himself as optimistic. But look, let me just pick up on what was said a little while ago, and that is, and it's an important point, the Bush people have a terribly ambitious agenda. They have all sorts of stuff they want to do. They want to do, you know, partially privatized Social Security, and they'd love to do school choice, and they'd love to do some kind of significant tax reform. And some measure that will be very popular. I think making the tax cut permanent will be a popular move. What they're up against is that although they have every intention of pursuing an agenda, they do have thin margins in Congress. And what Bush understands is that his chance to be on Mount Rushmore won't be defined by whether or not he gets a top rate from 36% to 32% or whatever. It'll be defined by how he does in the Middle East. And that means that when the crunch comes, and it always does in wartime, when you're dealing with the opposition, I think that most of his domestic agenda will grind down to almost nothing, because he'll have to wheel and deal over issues of filibusters and 60 votes for the Byrd Amendment on budgetary issues in the Senate and so on.
And war pushes out the energy.
I beg your pardon?
And war pushes out the energy perhaps to overcome all that.
I think war sucks up all the energy.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to put his political capital on one thing, and this is not unlike what happened to his father, who I worked for.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it before, and I sense it again, although I realize the Bush people think, no, we're much smarter, we'll never make those mistakes. But I think that history has a kind of statistical regression to it that is going to yank Bush in the direction of sitting there working with Robert Byrd and Tom Daschle and probably not Richard Gephardt, since apparently he's going to resign his leadership spot, but whoever it is, to hammer out some kind of bipartisan foreign policy, which will also inevitably mean a bipartisan domestic policy.
So there's that vortex of war and all that it may suck down with it. David's calling from Providence. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point. Maybe you've talked about it earlier, but you know the race was a lot closer than people are talking about. I mean, you've got a lot of races in Texas, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Missouri, Arkansas that just went down to the wire.
And True, and duly noted from the top, David, but we're looking at these majorities. We acknowledge sitting right beneath that is a very evenly divided country.
Right, and the point is Bush, I'm afraid he's going to make the same mistake he did earlier, thinking he's got a mandate. He's going to push the middle away from him, and he's going to lose the people like Jeffries that he already lost, the Chafees that are on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And to him and his father, this is a game. It's whatever it takes to win, and he's going to run with whatever he and Karl Rove thinks is to keep himself in power.
There's a thought. David, thanks for the call. John Forte, how about it? I guess, A, do you see wobbly senators in the mix here? Could this be turned around by more defections? And B, how strong is the ideological thread in George Bush's blanket here? Is he as opportunistic as our caller David suggests?
Well, I guess I view it almost as the beginning of a new presidency in that when a president comes in, he has some deference in Congress, a little bit of an opportunity, 6-8 months to push a domestic agenda with a little bit more verve than he might later in the presidency. Bush has been granted a second honeymoon, and you don't usually get them. In fact, you usually have the opposite problem after the midterm. So his base is behind him. He's gained congressional majorities. He has an opportunity. Down the road, I completely agree that these majorities are narrow, and doing anything through the legislative process that gets away from foreign policy, where executive action is easier on his own, is going to be difficult. That being said, the Democrats are going to face their own problems of division in their ranks and which way to oppose the Bush administration, whether to become a more ideological and liberal alternative or to blur the differences. And that may not be resolved quickly for them, and they may be in dissension, or maybe they'll come together in 6 months and be a very strong opposition in a time that Bush falls in trouble. So 2 years is a long time. But I see an early period of some greater hope for the Bush domestic agenda.
James Pinkerton, put the rest of it in perspective for us. You've known Ronald Reagan and two Bush presidents now. Our caller suggests the Bushes are the opportunistic ones, and they'll trim their ideology for victory. Look a little further out. We may have a full two-term president here, 8 years. How radical a stamp do you anticipate George W. Bush might leave if that's how it transpires?
Well, there's two different points here. One is I don't think he's particularly opportunistic. I think he's as opportunistic and clever and cunning as the average president, which is to say they all are. I think Karl Rove is a very smart guy. But I think the lesson of the last since Bush's State of the Union in January 2002 is that Bush is sort of the opposite of a take the easy way out, trim kind of politician. He took on the axis of evil. He's going to change the world. This isn't what pragmatic, get-along, go-along presidents do. That was, frankly, my critique of Bush.
That's true. So if we have another 6 years, what stamp do you see? How far will we be from the Clinton 90s at the end of a second Bush term?
Well, I'm not convinced that the war is going to go well and that there will be a second Bush term. I think that if the war goes badly, I think this could all end very quickly. James K. Polk was a very expansionist president in the 1840s against Mexico and was a one-termer.
There's the voice of experience, the reality check, talking
so,
to us.
Having said that, obviously if Bush gets his way, and if the country stays with him, and if there's more terrorism and there's more opportunity for military action. I mean, I sat through a lunch the other day with Michael Levine of the same American Enterprise Institute, who said that, you know, if America's going to be successful in the war on terror, it's got to take out Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia. And I know that those kind of voices are being heard in this administration.
Off we go. It's going to be a big time. James Pinkerton, we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us tonight and for your insights.
Thank you.
James Pinkerton was former White House aide in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He's author of What Comes Next, The End of Big Government and the New Paradigm Ahead. And John Fortier, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
John Fortier is with the American Enterprise Institute. Jack Beatty, there's a train of conquest to make. We'll have to talk about that some more. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Sure.
We are going to end tonight with sounds of some of the big winners in the Republican Party from the past 24 hours.
I was delighted to be in the office by 7 o'clock, talked to the president just after 7, and he started off the conversation by saying, Majority Leader, where are you, still at home? And I said, no, Mr. President, I'm in my office. Let's go to work. And that's the way I feel about the opportunity we have here. The American people have indicated that they want the Congress, the House, the Senate, the President to work together to get things done, to produce results, not get tangled up in the partisan politics that we saw so much of this year here in the Senate.
I also have a word of thanks to our President. I have a word of thanks to our President, George W. Bush. But having gone through this fire, This wall of fire to be here at this moment, I also need to have him sign an IOU. The president has come to Minnesota and has an interest in us now, and I intend to utilize that to help us deal with the major problems that we have.
I'm just pleased that all of you are now becoming our family, and we look forward to making sure that Georgia gets the best representation possible, not just in the U.S. House, but now in the United States Senate.
I think the first thing we want to do is take a look at American health care. A lot of people that don't have insurance out there, we need to make insurance and health care accessible. We also have to make it affordable, so that's something we want to do. You know, the Senate held up our pharmaceutical drug bill. It's another thing that we'd want to get done. And so there's some good things we need to move on. The gridlock that we've had is because the Senate has had the Democrat leadership, and the Senate has held that up. And I think that's one of the things the American people were had their backs up a little bit. You know, we should have had a Homeland Defense bill. We should have had an energy bill. There's a lot of things we should have done, but just couldn't get it through the Senate after we passed it out of the House.
You know, the last 2 years have been a difficult time for the leaders of our government, and particularly in the Senate. There's been a struggle, a sense that there was a tremendous struggle for power going on. It is time to set that aside. And even if we disagree about tactics, in many cases, we agree about what we want to do. And we should set our differences aside and try and accomplish them. That's not looking through rose-colored glasses. That's what every generation of leaders in America has done.
It may be policemen, law enforcement officers, or it may be waitresses or delivery men or nurses or our young men and women in the armed services. I'm going to fight for all of these people in the United States Senate. I'll fight for them.
And there is a celebrating GOP, the new Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Minnesota's new Senator Norm Coleman, Georgia's new Senator Saxby Chambliss, House Majority Leader Dennis Hastert, Missouri's new Senator Jim Talent, and Elizabeth Dole, the new U.S. Senator from North Carolina, all celebrating yesterday's big win for the Republican Party. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.